case of the morning. United States versus Combs, 11-1091, and for the appellant, Mr. Is it Sison?
Sison, Your
Honor. Sison.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Gilbert Sison, and I represent the defendant, Fontez Combs. The defendant appeals from the judgment and sentence of the district court of 33 months for his conviction for felon in possession of a firearm. Specifically, we believe that the trial court erred in finding no good cause for permitting the late filing of a motion to suppress, which would have been dispositive of the case. First of all, Your Honors, we believe that the trial court erred and committed clear error for three reasons. First, that the motion to suppress was filed well in advance of trial, about 2 months prior to the fixed trial date of September 20th. Second, that there were legitimate reasons for the delay, meaning that counsel did not have a good faith basis until about April or May to file that motion. And then finally, that there were other options available to the district court short of not considering the motion on the merits. First, Your Honors, let's go to the timeline, 2 months. Most cases that deal with Rule 12F usually are denied by the court and upheld by the various circuit courts across the country. But most of those cases usually come in the context of a late 11th hour filing. In other words, a filing on the day of trial or a filing right after the jury is sworn. And that's important because of the prejudice to the government in those types of situations. And that's critical to the analysis in the Sal Houghton case of which the defendant relies. Here, there was 2 months, enough time to consider the motion. There was no prejudice to the government because the jury had not been impaneled. And that was critical, again, in the court's analysis in Sal Houghton of which we rely. Secondly, the basis for the delay. As the record shows, the defense came in and entered their appearance, retained counsel, entered their appearance after the deadline for the motion for filing a pretrial motion had passed. The court was well aware through the process, and counsel was diligent in informing the court. We needed to unseal the warrant so we could get the information. We needed to view the videotape, which would give us a basis to determine whether or not we could attack the suppression motion through a Franks motion. And because of difficulties in obtaining that discovery, and through no fault of the government.
Mr. Sison,
yes, sir.
Your client pled guilty, though.
That's correct.
Without a conditional aspect to it, correct?
He pled guilty. He pled open, Your Honor.
Right. So how can he be here at all? Doesn't he waive rulings on all the pretrial matters by pleading guilty without reserving condition under 11A2, I think it is?
Well, first of all, I don't believe that he's waived it. First of all, we're not contesting.
Plea of guilty waives it. He doesn't have to say anything out loud. All he has to do is plead guilty.
Well, he does, but there's a difference between pleading guilty and accepting responsibility for the facts. But
there isn't. When you plead guilty, you waive all.
All defenses are gone when he pleads guilty, unless he's reserved under 11A2 by agreement with the government.
Well, because we pled open, there were no promises made between the government. Typically, when there is a plea agreement with the government, there is a reservation or an explanation that you are waiving those rights, and there was no such thing in the plea agreement or actually the open plea agreement with the government in this case.
Well, I think that poses a real difficult jurisdictional problem for us.
And I would say that the difference is that we don't think he waived it. Number one, there was no formal – I mean, a waiver is a waiver. It has to be a known and relinquishment of a known right.
That's where we bog down. That's not true. When he enters an open plea of guilty without any questions or qualifications, that's the end of that. I mean, you don't get to say, well, later on I should have done something more. It's done. It's over. And we have no jurisdiction to review it.
And the advice given at the guilty plea hearing encompasses that.
That's true.
By the court. The court in inquiring constitutes a waiver.
And that's true, Your Honor, but my recollection of the hearing and my recollection of the record was that there was no known relinquishment of that right.
What I'm suggesting to you is there does not have to be. You see, you waive your right to a trial by your waive your right to a trial before the court. The only thing left to the court is the sentencing. And there's no right beyond that. And that's the end of that.
Well, and I guess
That happens to be the brutal fact of the law. I mean, it's not a matter of something I dreamed up or anything.
Well, obviously, I would concede to the court that it probably would have been safer if there probably would have been more appropriate if the counsel had.
You might even have saved it, but you didn't.
Right.
Were you trial counsel?
I was not, Your Honor. It was
whoever was there didn't save anything for you to play games with.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Whoever was there doing it didn't leave anything for you to play games with. That's the problem.
Well,
it's noble of you to try, but.
Well, that's the case, Your Honor. My only position on that would be simply that before you relinquish a known right, I think that it has to be a known. And in other words, the defendant has to know what he's doing, has to know that he's giving up that right specifically. I don't think there's anything in the record that would indicate that. But assuming that we can get beyond that, Your Honors, I think there are two points that I'd like to make in regard to why we believe the district court committed clear error. So first, is the court focused on the fact that that the deadline had passed for 6 months, that there had been no motion for extending the time granted, even though the court was well aware throughout the entire process that the defendant was going to file a motion to suppress. Now, granted, the actual proper procedure probably wasn't followed in this case, but that doesn't mean that the district court did not know. And first of all, the district court focused simply on the fact that 6 months had passed and that there was no time to do this before the trial occurred on September 20th. I'll grant you and concede that the district court does retain a lot of discretion in managing their trial calendar. But in assessing the reasonableness and whether or not the arbitrariness of a district court's decision, one needs to look at whether there are other options, because you have the defendant's rights here that are also at stake as well. And first of all, there are a couple of options that could have been available. Number one, it could have been referred to a magistrate. Now, concededly, it could not have been referred to Magistrate Wilkerson, because Magistrate Wilkerson was the one that actually did the search warrant, but Magistrate Frazier was available down in Bend, and it could have been referred to him. Secondly, it could have been taken up prior to the case on the day of trial. The hearing could have been held the day of, and I know that's a procedure that I personally have been involved with when there's a motion to suppress, and we don't want to delay.
That's pretty efficient, because the day of trial, you've got jurors there, prospective jurors, and if it's an adverse ruling to the defendant, his mind might change. You wasted the jurors' time. That's why the court set the schedule.
Oh, that's true, but I think there needs to be a balance involved, too.
Who is Mr. Hill that's referred to on page 16 of your brief?
Mr. Hill is another person that Mr. Fine was handling.
In a different case.
Yes, it was a different case before the same judge. And Mr. Fine, unfortunately, one of the reasons for the delay was because he had had that case which was going to go to trial, but then it pled at the last minute. He'd had another case that was did go to trial, and then he suffered a bout of pneumonia, which basically incapacitated him for some time, which is the reason for the delay between the May 4th order, in which Judge Reagan indicated that you should do these certain things.
It's hard to understand why there's discussion of Mr. Hill's case in the middle of this brief.
Right, and that's the reason why. I think it provides some context. It was one of the reasons why the district court
I have a totally sappy question. Is there really a guy named Wade Gummersheimer floating around someplace?
Yes, there is, Your Honor, and I've actually dealt with him on a couple of occasions in other cases that I've investigated.
Is that how I pronounce you, Gummersheimer?
I think so, but I'm not sure. I usually just call him Wade, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, I would too, yeah.
But again, the point goes to, were there other options available? There were. And as a matter of fact, the district court knew all along. And one thing that I'd like to point out is the district court seemed to focus on two things, its trial calendar and the fact that 6 months had passed. And it didn't seem to give effect to the reasons why there was a delay in the first place, reasons for which the trial court granted two continuances. And that's important because of the interplay between Rule 45 and Rule 12. Rule 45 permits the court to extend any deadlines when there's good cause and if there's excusable neglect from counsel. And in this case, if the same reasons that permitted the continuance of the trial on two occasions arguably could have been sufficient to permit the late filing of the motion in this case. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Fine. Thank you. Is it Cutchin? Mr. Cutchin?
Not Gummersheimer.
I'm sorry?
Not Gummersheimer.
No, I wouldn't even know how to pronounce that or spell it. Your Honor, my name is Jim Cutchin. I am an assistant U.S. attorney. I do represent the government. I was not the attorney below, and I was not involved in preparing the brief, but I have familiarized myself with the facts and record and will do my best to answer the court's questions.
Speaking of your brief, on the jurisdictional statement, you say that the defendant appellant's jurisdictional statement is complete and correct. So these questions we've been asking Mr. Cisson about his failure to preserve the matter regarding the motion to suppress, have you waived the waiver of that?
Your Honor, I believe that is the case. When I was assigned this case Friday and picked up the brief, that was the first question.
Knock. Can you waive jurisdiction in this issue?
Well, Your Honor, that's the second question I looked at. Was 11A2 jurisdictional? I think there's a substantial question, again, as an officer of the court, of whether that's the case. There is some case law, there are some cases of this case that use the word jurisdiction in addressing 11A2. But the Supreme Court, as well as some other courts of appeal that have directly addressed the issue of whether 11A2 is jurisdictional, have said that statements like that go more to the court's ability under the rules to hear rather than the appellate jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction.
Well, yeah, appellate jurisdiction to say we have no reason to rule. We're unable to rule on it.
Yes, Your Honor. Had the government presented, I believe the state of the law is, had the government in its brief address the Rule 11A2 issue, this court would have been without authority under the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure to hear the
case. But you think the government can waive that jurisdictional problem?
Your Honor, if the court is inclined to find that it's jurisdictional, no, the government cannot waive the jurisdictional. If the court is...
Well, I'll also describe it.
Well, Your Honor, there's the Supreme Court...
If we're inclined to favor your side, you're willing to agree with us.
Your Honor, I am more than willing to agree with the court if the court wants to do that. There was a case the Supreme Court addressed a couple of terms ago called Eberhardt, in which they indicated that Rule 33's limitation on the court's power was not jurisdictional. If the court, this court has made statements again in the past saying 11A2 is jurisdictional, and certainly the court remains free to take that position. If for some reason the court were to determine that it did not have jurisdiction to, did have jurisdiction to hear this case, and the government had waived that issue, I would just note that the district court's actions in this case were certainly well within its prerogative to do. It was not clear error for the court to do what it did. This court, in addressing denials of motions as untimely under Rule 12, has said it's appropriate to review with great deference what the district court did, and the district courts possess great authority to manage their caseload, and that cause, the standard under Rule 12E and formerly 12F, is a very stringent standard. In this case, the district court warned the defendant that he needed to seek leave in order to file a motion to any pretrial motions. In this case, defense counsel did not do so. He did not file a motion, a substantive motion, until 171 days after the entry of appearances, 85 days after receiving the information that the defendant concedes was necessary to file the motion, and 74 days after being warned of the need to seek leave by the district court. In ruling on the motions and the subsequent motions to reconsider and motions for leave, the district court noted that it had had substantial problems with the defendant's firm, the defendant's lawyers in this and other cases, and that noted that it even went to the steps of sending a letter to the firm in order to complain about the diligence with which it approached matters appearing before it. It's clear that the district court took the extraordinary steps in this case to warn defense counsel of what he needed to do. He didn't do it, and he suffered the consequences under Rule 12. It was not clear error. An argument that the government did preserve by a waiver argument the government did preserve is that even if the court were to find that there were good cause and the district court somehow erred, the defendant would still have to show that there was prejudice from the district court refusing to hear the motion. He waived that argument by not presenting it in his brief. As the government pointed out, this court has repeatedly said that the litigants must present issues and cite legal authority. The defendant did not even address the prejudice argument in his brief. Therefore, based on that waived argument, he could not prevail anyway.
Judge Reagan's comments about the firm, the difficulty he had experienced with that, were not directed at Mr. Ceeson.
No, Your Honor, exactly not. I believe they were directed toward Mr. Rosenblum, who is the named member of the firm. I don't know. The records are not clear, and the district judge didn't say about any other individuals in that firm.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ceeson.
Actually, to clarify, Your Honor, I did have one case that Judge Reagan did note in the letter to my boss, which Judge Reagan did complain about, so I wanted to disclose that for full honesty. But first, with respect to rebut quickly the government's points on prejudice, do we have to show prejudice? No. The Saladin case makes that very clear. As a matter of fact, Saladin did not even focus on the prejudice to the defendant. It is a consideration that the court can consider, but it's not a requirement. As a matter of fact, the critical analysis in Saladin was the prejudice to the government. Secondly, with respect to the timing. Now, granted, from May 4th to July 16th, when the motion was filed, there was a 2.5-month delay in which arguably counsel should have sought an extension for a motion of time. The problem is here is that this is unlike other cases where it's put on the court at the last minute. The court didn't know about it. It surprises the court. Here, that's not the case. The court knew about it, and the court saw fit to continue it on the basis that they knew the defense counsel was going to seek leave to file a motion. And here, Your Honors, the court made it very clear that this was good enough to continue the trial, but then it can't have its cake and eat it, too, and say that it's not good enough to grant an extension. And, again, when you look at the reasonableness of everything, you look at other options, and one important consideration is the consideration of the defendant. And if I could just finish my thought, I know that my
finish
time is up. The Saladin case notes that Rule 12 is not a finicky procedural requirement. Here, the purpose of Rule 12 is to promote efficient trials and to prevent delay tactics by the defendant. That's not the case here. As a matter of fact, it actually promotes inefficiency if we don't send it back to the district court because you open up a counsel to a Rule 2255, at least a viable Rule 2255.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ceeson, and thank your firm, you and your firm, for representing the client on this case.
Thank you.